Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Kalnin, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Well, welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life science sector. As usual, we'll be covering topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries as we aim to shake up the paradigm and revolutionize the way in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. So for episode 35, we are journeying back in the product lifecycle to the clinical trial phase, and Lori is going to tell us more about a very special guest that joined her to discuss ICH E6-03, the Guideline for Good Clinical Practice, which was just published in 2025, and which builds upon the ICH E8 General Considerations for Clinical Studies, which came a couple of years beforehand in 2021. So this update to E6-03 guideline has been developed to encourage a risk-based and proportionate approach and ensure that it's applied to the conduct of clinical trials. So Lori, why don't you fill us in on who is your special guest this month?
Yeah, thank you, Nuala. So Joy Whitsett is my special guest this month, and she is one of the most pragmatic clinical quality people I've worked with. I really enjoy working with her, especially on this clinical risk management program. She's very practical about how she thinks about it. She is a regulatory and quality professional. I think she's had over 25 years of experience. She is a consultant right now, and she has worked on both the sponsor and vendor side. So I think that's what brings that approach. She sees both sides, and she's able to find that right-sized approach. And she's an independent consultant. I should be clear about that too. So we had, I think, a very enjoyable conversation about it and have had several good conversations about it. And I'm really excited to share this. So why don't we take a listen to the interview?
Lori, before we play the interview, could I just say one thing? When I first sat down to listen to it, my honest reaction was clinical trial risk management. It isn't really my space. I'm not sure this will be relevant to me. But actually, that turned out to be the gift of the conversation, because I wasn't listening from inside my own usual manufacturing QRM world. And I noticed as a result, I was listening differently. I wasn't arguing with myself in my head. I wasn't thinking that wouldn't work in our system, or we've tried that before, but yes, in practice, you know, wasn't having those little mental arguments. I was just listening, reflecting and learning. And I found that gift of listening outside my own discipline. My defences, my biases were all a little quieter. And so, yeah, I'd encourage the listeners to do the same, because it really was so interesting to listen to QRM earlier in the life cycle. So, yeah, let's listen.
All right. I want to welcome everyone to another episode of Risk Revolution. Today, we have Joy Whitsett. She's our expert clinical person that we're going to talk to today. And our topic is going to be clinical risk management. I'm really excited to have you, Joy. Thank you for coming on to the show with us.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate being invited and look forward to our discussion.
Okay, Joy, when you think about risk management in clinical trials today, what does good look like?
Well, I think from a risk management standpoint, the industry is evolving, right? So what we've been doing is we've been incorporating risk management in kind of a rote way and a defined way. But the emerging areas where risk management is being more adopted and more relevant is really coming from the changes that happened with ICH E6-03, where there's more of a focus on risk and more of a focus on thoughtfully incorporating risk into clinical trial design and clinical trial management as sort of two integrated teams instead of separate teams. I think that the industry has always considered risk. We have always had lots of controls when it comes to risky clinical trials, right? Where you've got products that maybe there's a lot that's not known about them, or maybe they have a potential to have unknown effects, especially something like biologics, replicating retroviruses, you know, risky products, or even risky patient populations. People talk about risk a lot, think about risk a lot, think about the patient a lot. I think what's happening now is the industry is moving towards now taking those concepts around clinical study design and then kind of more formally putting this quality by design into the way you run a clinical trial and extending it, right? So it's instead of it being sort of one-off conversations, the intention is for it to be more integrated. But that being said, you know, where it's at right now is, you know, is not fully adopted, right? Teams, you know, clinical trials run for a long time. Clinical study management and how to run a clinical trial is being done by the same people that did it before ICHE-6CR3 came out. And, you know, a lot of those well-worn pathways of setting up a study, running a study, getting the data in, all of those kind of operational nuts and bolts, they're just in progress. And sometimes you're just turning on a light switch when you're trying to run a new study. And there's always so much pressure to get a study started. Sometimes you have a study protocol that is fully resourced, fully, you know, developed before even FDA has aligned on the clinical trial endpoints, you know. So a lot of times they're trying to run and get startup done very quickly. And that's also when you should be doing your risk assessment. And so there's a competition for resources and brain cells a little bit for when it's coming up. And so now what we see is kind of trying to retrofit those things that should have been done at the beginning of the study into ongoing trials or, you know, when a study is early in development. So I'm not sure that actually answers your question, but that's really where it's at, right?
Yes,
it's being done, but what we want good to look like is really that beginning phase, right? That quality by design phase, starting from the beginning and really looking at a protocol and identifying where the risk areas are.
Yeah, and I think it's important what you said too, that we should note in the very beginning of this podcast is that I don't want to imply in this discussion that risk isn't being considered and hasn't been considered throughout the history of clinical trial management. I think certainly there's been a huge evolution over the years of things to be considered to protect that patient and data. Now I think it's bringing a formality to it and a timeliness to it that maybe a lot of clinicians aren't used to, right? And I think that's important to note that certainly I don't want to imply that was never considered before. It just wasn't documented maybe what is being asked now in R3 and at the timing that it's being asked to be documented in R3 too. And I think that's important to note. And for those of my friends that listen to the podcast that are on the GMP side, quality by design is coming for you. It's something that we faced a while ago. I think we still struggle with today. And I think it's just interesting to see it now evolve more and more in the GCP space. Certainly it was there in R2 and a heavier presence even in R3. So it's on its way, or it's coming, it's there, right? Expectations are building around that. So so from your experience, how does effective risk-based thinking impact that clinical trial quality? How have you seen that kind of operate?
Yeah, so I like what you were saying about, you know, from those on the GMP side of the house. You know, there was a time when we were learning on the GMP side from device. But now everyone that you work with on the CMC side of the house knows what quality by design is, and we're in different levels of sort of expertise in being able to incorporate it. You know, the same is really much more true on the GCP side of the house, where a lot of my colleagues have never heard the word quality by design being applied to running a clinical study. I mean, it's really been in the hands of clinical operations, right? GMPs require that you have a quality assurance unit, and it defines what a quality control unit looks like, right? GCPs do not. They define quality assurance activities. And we have these really nice guidance documents, but who is supposed to execute them, right? Is it right. supposed to be ClinOps? Is it supposed to be quality assurance? Is it supposed to be some other group within the organization, or is it, does it really rely on consultants like you and I? A lot of times for small and mid-sized companies, it's consultants, right? And so kind of operationally, like how do we start to, you know, really infuse this idea of quality by design, and how do we really start to help our clients and sponsors understand how to really adopt it and take kind of the mystery out of it. So I like to not use those words. So I don't ever say quality tolerance limit. I don't think clinical teams are interested in it. I think they see it as time wasting and exhausting and not really practical. So I think what really helps is if you don't try to use that language, but instead try to apply the concepts, right? So conceptually, what is happening is that most studies are outsourced, right? And most people, our companies are relying on a vendor, like any type of CRO. And the CRO will manage operationally the conduct of the study. The CRO is a vendor, though. I mean, they've got, you know, a work scope, and they do the work scope, and embedded in their work scope is always risk management. But where are they getting the foundations for how they identify what the risks might be and how to mitigate them? The truth is they are honestly getting them a little bit out of the box. So every study, and they are really looking at it from a project management lens, right? So they are very focused on PM timelines, risk to timelines, risk to executing the monitoring plan. But those risks are fine and appropriate, but they're not necessarily the risks that matter most to patients or matter most to the clinical study design of the protocol. And so what we want to try to do now is take that thinking, right? Okay, you already have your spreadsheet that says detectability, you know, severity,
impact,
you know, can you find it? What are you going to do about it? How are you going to mitigate it? But instead of just filling out these spreadsheets from the operations side, the idea is that the sponsor would look at the protocol from a design perspective, right? So at the very beginning of the study, and get the right stakeholders involved in identifying, hey, I want to do this study, and I'm looking at a potential treatment for this indication, right? Like whatever it might be, like a cancer indication or a pediatric indication. And just from the nature of the study and what we're trying to do, the type of product it is, where are the highest risks to patients? And I think that thinking of where are the things that are scariest, right? If we just sat down and we thought about it from like a human standpoint, what would keep you from enrolling in this clinical study? Like where from that kind of side of the house, that clinical study design side, what matters most to you? And to me, this is very integrated with another emerging trend that happened, especially around 2016 with the 21st Century Cures Act and patient-focused drug development, and asking patients about what matters to them when we are designing a clinical study and defining what the endpoints are going to be. So it always starts from the beginning. It's always like, you know, beginning with the end in mind. So when we think about risk and how to make it palpable and an actually like an important thing, is when we think about it from those talking points. What matters most? What matters most to protecting the patients that enroll in the study? What data matter the most in identifying whether or not this drug is going to work and whether or not it's safe for the patients that take it? Like, stop using the jargon. You know what
I
mean?
Just talk about
what it really is.
Yes.
And yes, I do want a new treatment for breast cancer, but do I want a Me Too treatment that is just another drug that does exactly what's out there already? No. And yes, I do want a new treatment for, you know, Parkinson's, but will that treatment be for a person that was just diagnosed, not a person that is late stage, right? So what can we do to help patients earlier in the study and what risks are they willing to take, you'll find that that changes with the patient population. Younger people that get diagnosed with cancer are willing to take aggressive, risky procedures and drugs and investigational products. Older people, when they get diagnosed with cancer, are less so. They want to maintain their quality of life and they don't want to be sick all the time. You know, those things need to be embedded into how we run a study. Okay, I'm in an older patient population. They have cancer. They have transportation limitations. I'm going to reduce the number of assessments that I need to make. What really matters? How often does a patient really need to come to the clinic and take the time to come to the clinic? You know, if I'm, you know, diagnosed with cancer and I want to see my grandkids, I'm going to see my grandkids. I'm not going to go to the clinic. I don't want to be burdening patients. So that's really the risk. So those, when you start thinking about those risks and the sponsor is telling the CRO, these are the things I want you to make sure that we prioritize, then it becomes less like busy work, right?
Yeah.
It's like, but right now what's happening is the sponsor's never doing that. And so the CRO is never getting that. And then the CRO is kind of just running the risk assessments that they do that are more operationally focused. Nothing wrong with it. They just don't have a lot of really true benefit coming from the kind of patient-focused drug development and sort of this like clinical development risk assessment that we talk about a lot. So that's the thing. So now you kind of have people like with ICHE6R3 coming out. Now inspectors are coming and they're asking what you're doing for risks. And the sponsors are going to the CRO and saying, what are you doing to manage risk? And the sponsors are going, the CRO is going, well, the sponsor never told us what the risks were. So we've been managing these risks, you know, and none of it is really sensical.
Yeah.
So anyway, I know when we talked about this podcast from the beginning, you were like, okay, well, where's like a place where you've like, you know, really like been able to set these quality control limits? The answer is nowhere. We are emerging, like this is starting. Yeah. And it starts with helping people understand how to first identify like what's important in the study and then how to practically apply. How do you do that in real life with the study teams that you have, right? Yeah. A little bit of it is education. And like what we've talked about in the past, Lori, is it can't be going from 0 to 100. Like you really have to do it stepwise and help people understand how to practically implement it. And I think that's what you're so great at is identifying, okay, here's a practical baby step. Of how to start thinking about risk and how it guides your decision making. But for me, I think that it's all very timely and it's all very much should be focused on this patient centric drug development kind of approach, and then building on that and identifying where the risks are that are based sort of from that paradigm. And I think that's where that's why I like this set of guidance documents so much, and just even the unity we're seeing across, you know, FDA and EMA here, we're seeing the same things being requested all the time, and that's bringing up the industry to sort of think about what should we be thinking about, and then also stop wasting time on the things that really aren't that important and are really just taking up time and paper.
Well, I just love how it reinforces numerous times what matters most, right? The most important thing. I think at ICHE8, it even calls out at some point, you know, don't deal with nuisance items. You know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, right? It really is.
Yeah.
And I love your focus on the participant. I should use the proper language, the participant well-being. It's it's all throughout there. And that is where the win is for the risk management. Because I think on the GMP side, we still deal with the same things. Oh, yeah, I'll do that risk assessment because it's required. I have to do that, right? I have to check that box. We're still struggling there. But here it's so clearly delineated that it's all about the participant well-being, protecting that data. What is true data you really need to make decisions for this product? And I mean, going back to what you were saying too around the number of visits, I have glaucoma, and I was actually asked one time to participate in a study being in the job I'm in, I was like, sure, I'm in, you know, what do I need to do? So I got the informed consent form and the person sat down with me. And within like 5 minutes, I said, this is not possible because they needed 4 visits per day for me to come to the clinic to actually have them check my eye pressure. Now, this was for some sort of device that was going to sit in my eye and slowly release medication, right? Instead of me having to do an eye drop. Back to the participant well-being. I would rather give myself an eye drop every night, which I have done since I was 16 years old, than have a device stuck into my eye that was slowly releasing medication. Sounded like it was slightly uncomfortable a little bit. And for the trial, I was going to have to go 4 times a day back and have them check my pressure. I said, are you joking? Was what I actually said. Who could actually do that? Now, mind you, I believe, I don't know what the total population enrollment was, given that glaucoma is typically identified in an older patient population. I don't know if they were thinking, sure, this is viable, people can go to the clinic. But I thought, what a great opportunity where that risk assessment would have really helped. Because I think when you get the scientist or the clinical development person that's like, we can do this and I need this data and this is going to be great versus the operation side that goes, is it? Is the patient going to be able to come there? That's where I think that risk assessment is so great because you sort of have the design versus the reality, right, of what's actually going to happen, you know? And yeah, and I, it was interesting. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you need all the stakeholders at the table. And so that, like, that is what I like about ICHE8 is it talks about like how you want to make sure that in the design portion of your study that you're engaging all the stakeholders. Problem that we have is we don't involve patients and caregivers early in study trial design. Now, with the 21st Century Cures Act, now FDA is required to incorporate in their reviews how they used patient experience data to inform their decision to approve the drug or not, or to or the supplement. So that's all very good, but patient experience data has been limited a little bit to outcomes that are measured in the protocol as endpoints. So patient-reported outcomes, clinician-reported outcomes, caregiver observer outcomes. Those are kind of patient experience data, and I fully agree. And I think that those are more important endpoints than biomarkers because they. And I'm not saying that because of me. I'm just saying that I agree with FDA that that's a direct measure of clinical benefit. Because you're saying as a patient, I experienced this. This is my symptom. I took this medication, and that symptom that I care about got better. Right. So to me, that's important, that internal reporting that I believe that I'm better, and me saying that on a questionnaire or some way of reporting that I got better, to me is a direct measure of clinical benefit. So that's important. So, yeah, we're using them now as endpoints and we're getting that information more. But what you're talking about is done less. And what I think So first of all, we aren't incorporating patients a lot when we do a clinical study design. There are ways to get that information, and they're important. It's also important to think about who we're recruiting and how we're going to reflect diversity in that patient population.
Oh, totally. Yes.
And this is another like critical thing that is a real problem because, again, you have clinical trials and even patient experience data studies like focus groups and one-on-one interviews where you're recruiting using the same well-worn pathways that you've always used. And guess who you get? You get middle-aged white women. You don't get diversity. You don't get a lot of communities participating that could benefit from the drug or are represented in the patients that you plan to market that drug for. And so that's another thing that needs to be addressed is these patient preference studies, and then actually going to community and getting their feedback on the feasibility of a clinical trial and what you could do to improve that that design to make it more more accessible and more kind of value to the people that are eventually going to be your market, right? And so another thing to think about, like what you were saying, is I would prefer to take an eye drop at night. versus going into a clinic. So there are studies that you can do that are called patient preference studies. And what you do is you design a study where you think about like a different types of treatment. One would be an injectable. Another would be going into the clinic for this device. Another would be an eye drop every day. And then what you do is you just ask patients what they would prefer. Nice. And that's another way to get that informed and then inform the design of the actual product itself and how it would be administered. So I personally would, I'm the same. I don't want to go into a doctor's office for any reason whatsoever. But there are a lot of people that are really averse to taking, even like giving themselves an injection. They would rather not. I'd rather go to the doctor once a month versus having to do this once a week by myself, you know, and that's important to know too. So anyway, I'm just saying all that to say that where does risk kind of incorporate in all of this? We have to have all the stakeholders at the table to know it, right? Because we are in a bubble. All of us are in a bubble. We need a stats person on the team. We need a person from the patient population. We need a caregiver. And we need to we need to thoughtfully design these protocols that aren't just getting the data that we think we need to get a drug approved, but also getting the data that are valuable and most informant to not just regulators, but also to the patients themselves. Collect the data that matters to me so that when I go to make a decision about what to do and how to treat any condition that I might have, I have that information available and it's relevant to me.
Yeah.
And the people that have participated in the study are diverse and representative. And then the scientific value of the data is more important. And, you know, I just bring that up because one of the things you talked about was like, how do we incorporate trials to improve clinical outcomes, right? Our discussions earlier. And outcomes are harder to control, right? Because, you know, we don't know when we're dealing with investigational medicinal products, whether or not there is a true benefit, right?
Right.
But an outcome that matters, you'll know if you talk to people and you ask them what matters to them, and then you measure those things that they say mattered, right? So if I said, I would prefer to go to the doctor's office and I'm really looking to reduce my cough, and I'm able to design a study that has reasonable times that you need to go in and be seen to be a part of the trial, but then also subsequently, and I'm able to design a product that addresses cough, then you have meaningful benefit in eventual drugs. That doesn't mean that you have a perfect clinical study, but that brings in the data and it starts measuring things that matter to people. So anyway, so that those are my thoughts kind of around how you think about outcomes. Like when I'm designing an outcome, it needs to be patient focused.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love your comments. And I think to me, that's where I see that direct benefit of risk being incorporated into this process as you see it right away and how that participant is going to be managed in that study. Are they going to be given a tool they have to use? Did we properly train them on it, or is it going to confuse them? If it's an older population versus a younger population, could they possibly break it? You know, could they possibly not know how to get into it? Do they lose their password? You know, just so many things I think that are so great to understand. I remember my mom was a type 1 diabetic, and just even being able to dial the numbers at some point because of her age and also the vision problems that can happen with a type 1 diabetic over time made things a little bit more difficult for her to be able to manage her dosing of her insulin pen, you know, kind of thing. Those are things I think they should take into consideration during that development of that protocol, because that even plays out to how the final, you know, product's going to look, right? That's the purpose of going through the trial, is not just, is this going to work? Is it not going to work? How much is it going to work? But also, what's it going to look like when it finally gets to commercial, right? How much data can we collect on that so that when we go full launch, we're ready, right, for that patient population? So, yeah.
No, it's actually really critical. So for completing questionnaires, right, like a lot of them are being delivered on devices, but a lot of companies are not taking the time to do usability testing to ensure that the people that are completing it, that it's easy for them to complete. You know, the truth is that there is a lot of studies out there that show that older patients are fine with technology. they just need to be trained and they need some time to come up to speed. And they also need to have it be kind of fit for purpose, right? Well, it's like if I'm going to be needing to fill out the same thing every time, like let's make sure that the font size is there. Let's make sure that I get the appropriate alarms. Let's make sure that the question makes sense to me and that the response options make sense to me. And those, that type of design into the quality by design, into even just how you're collecting the data, not even the questionnaire itself, but just how you're collecting the data is really important. And the data are going to be more integral, like because they're representing exactly what the patient is experiencing, not they just had to get into the diary and hit two and move on with their day and not think about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, And at the end of the day, those are the types of things you want to be looking at, like when you're looking at operationally how to conduct a study. What's been happening is risk management, right? It hasn't really been part of how people execute clinical trials. Like it's just really typical to just sort of run a checklist, just send monitors, have them review these things, and then write a report, and then we review the report, and then we move on. And we're always going to use this system, and or we're going to use different systems for every study. We just click it up, and then we have the study coordinator train on it, and then we monitor that they brought in the data. So it can be really, really just a list of stuff we do. But what clinical risk management is supposed to be is that we think about what we're doing and say, do we need to be doing that, right? It's not a way to just say, no, I don't need to do it because of risk. You know, I don't want to do that monitoring visit because risk. But do I need to write a note to file for everything under the planet? Absolutely not.
Right.
Right. Do I need to be worrying about whether or not I've got, you know, a training form for, you know, a procedure from every single person that's at the site? Or do I really just need to focus and make sure that the people that are doing the assessments are appropriately qualified, right? So again, it's just that, like, instead of papering a study and just throwing down notes to file and throwing down training forms and throwing down monitoring visit reports, that really we start looking at what the quality of those are. Like, how are we monitoring the right data? Like, are you spending all day and all night on a piece of data that is being used as an exploratory endpoint and FDA is not incorporating into their review meaningfully? Or are we really spending data trying to understand what patients' experience is with the drug and while they are in this study? Like, are they getting better? Are they able to appropriately tell you that based on the way you've structured the study? Or are they just exhausted? Sometimes you've got some endpoints are, among others, like among getting their blood drawn and all of the other things that they have to go into an imaging appointment, they also have to do a 6-minute walk test. So if they're doing a 6-minute walk test, let's think about that practically and whether or not it's going to show that I had a really busy day and that's how far I could walk, or is it going to show whether or not the drug is working or not? You know what I mean? And so we have to think about those things critically when we're talking about how we conduct the study. And so, the tools that we've developed, right, and that you work with companies all the time on how to implement, those are just an agnostic way for us to get ourselves out of it, right? Because I have opinions. Like every meeting I come to, I've got an opinion.
Too.
But if we can talk through it with a reasonable risk based method, then that helps get the personalities out of the room, if that makes sense. And it helps us make better decisions because we're thinking about it with a paradigm that is prioritizing the things that are most important, not just the things that are most important to me.
That's right.
I mean, and every stakeholder has an opinion.
Yes, and that's 100% how I even start facilitation. Sometimes I'll just say, all right, let's get it out on the table. What's the thing you're worried about before we even bring some kind of, you know, construct to it? I'll just be like, let's get it out there. And I always see my job as the facilitator to make whatever the formal tool has to be, because we have to have those sometimes. I make that work on the side. but I should be able to have a conversation with you as a one human to another. We manage risk every day in everything we do. Can we just talk about this and me not going, what's the failure mode and the effect, you know, or whatever the language is, like you said, right? Can we just talk about risk like two humans? I can take that back and put it in whatever, you know, template we need to make that happen, to make that fit, you know, the requirements. ICH E6 is quite prescriptive about what it wants you to assess, but we can do that separately. We can just talk with that team, that study management team, or whatever you want to call it, that cross-functional group with the biostats, data management, all of that, and say, all right, what are the things that are most critical, unique? I always say too, what's unique and different, you know, for the participant? Or for us as a sponsor, right? Is this something we're familiar with? Is this a new device we're using or a new, you know, clinical sort of test that we're evaluating? How many MRIs are we asking this person to show up for? Because maybe that's concerning to them, right? You know, I think those are the questions, and you don't even have to use any kind of special terms in that discussion. So what are your thoughts on just how we get people? Because I also noticed that study management teams or whatever cross-functional body that people call that, that manage that study, they could be sometimes challenging to get sort of to talk, jump in and talk and have a whole discussion. Right. What are your thoughts on kind of getting people to talk that way, right? Just to talk about risk.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think you've got to meet people where they are. I mean, you know, when we think about who we've got, you know, around the table when we're designing a protocol, you've got very highly scientific folks that are not necessarily patient facing, like data managers and statisticians. And then you also have, you know, usually a clinical development team that is very patient facing. Usually that's a medical team, people that are clinicians or ex-clinicians that are very focused on the patient and nothing else. And we just got to get this treatment out there. And I know this is the best thing for them. And then you have clinical ops people that are really focused on just getting this done. And they understand how to run a study, but they don't necessarily have a lot of expertise on the specific indication or the drug itself, right? So you've got people that are all coming from these different places. Listen, my point of view sometimes is a lot of times I'll develop it by myself, right? Like, so I'll put like a risk assessment together and it may have, or probably does have, all of the wrong readings.
Yeah.
I like to kind of get people to think by putting a rating out there that is just to start the conversation. Like, okay, from my perspective, this is high risk. I don't know anything about this rare disease or, you know, or anything else. And then like see what people's responses are and help them react to it. Also, I also think sometimes it's best to kind of start with ClinDev and ClinOps and then bring in the other teams.
I like that.
I'm just a little biased on that because I feel like they manage the protocol more. Stats and data managers are really important because they know that they need clean data. So for people that aren't always working in clinical studies, like what happens a lot is that you have these systems that are built with edit checks that look for like variations that like can't happen, right? Like, okay, I can't have a blood pressure of 600. So the system is going to flash a query for that. But then there's other things that you can query because you're like, that data doesn't look right. Data managers think like that. And they are really good at identifying where people might be making mistakes a lot because they see it all the time, right? Like, oh yeah, they always transpose those numbers or they're always thinking in the metric system or, you know what I mean? Like they just know kind of differences in the way that people approach putting data in and bringing data in and cleaning data. And they know the things they've had to query like multiple times. Ugh, you know, you're not going to use that clinic. Like they never get it right. Or please don't use, you know, that MRI vendor because their system is, you know, a different system than everything else we have in the study. They see those differences in the data, but they don't necessarily want to talk about, you know, study visits and blood draws and stuff like that. They think about it from a data perspective, if that makes sense. So anyway, I'm just saying all that to say that I think it usually helps to kind of just meet people where they are, like start talking about the things that matter to them, start pushing the limits a little bit to get people out of their shell. Because sometimes you're trying to get the attention of a chief medical officer who is dealing with a lot of different complex issues. And for when I say, hey, I want you to come to a risk assessment meeting, they're like, okay, I'm going to be looking at my phone the whole time. You know?
Right.
But when you start to talk about, no, this is, I want you to tell me about this disease. I want you to tell me about what patients are going through when they're thinking about whether or not they should participate in the study. And also, you know, I also think a lot of the things that they bring up and they talk about, it informs the ClinOps people on what they need to be doing when they're training the sites, when they're building the consent form, because the consent form should be built for people. It shouldn't be built for lawyers. It should be built for the people that are considering whether or not they want to be in that study. And a lot of times everybody else is thinking about the legal risk or the compliance risk. But what we should be thinking about is what is the ethical risk. Right. And do the patients understand what they're getting into before they sign that form? And have we given them the appropriate time to do it? And does it have all of the things in it that matter? Right. Like sometimes I read a consent form and I'm like, look, I've seen a lot of clinical trials and I don't understand this. You know,
right. That's pretty bad.
Am I on the experimental arm?
Yeah.
If this thing you're talking about, is that the drug or is that the, is that the approved drug or what is an approved drug? You know, like those types of things, I don't think they're built patient focused again. But anyway, so those are my thoughts on how to kind of start the ball rolling and get people thinking about risk in their day-to-day lives. And it always is, I think, the more you can make it like human and the more you can make it kind of what people are dealing with in their day-to-day work life, and they feel part of the conversation, then you have effective risk assessments.
Yeah.
But when you don't have them is when everybody is like, God, when is this meeting going to end? I don't want to talk about failure mode anymore. But when I do say, I think that this study is going to, you know, I think that this study is potentially going to have an SAE on the first patient, or I think that this study has a high likelihood of a person becoming pregnant on your first patient. And then have people get their back up and say, no, that won't happen. Well, tell me why.
Right.
Like convince me otherwise. And what do you have in place that de-risks it and brings that down? And then you're talking about it like a person, right?
Right. Or
like
here's an idea
too. Buy the house or not, you know?
Right. let's also reduce, maybe it'll reduce the number of protocol amendments, right? Or maybe it'll reduce the number of protocol deviations. Those are things we don't want to have to deal with as well, right? So I mean, and I think setting your relationship with your CRO up to be more successful too. That transition over is going to be so much more powerful, and it might reduce the noise that sometimes can get into those risk assessments because the CRO is kind of using the cookie cutter, right? Well, they didn't give me anything, so I'll just go with what I know, right? Versus getting handed over. Here's the very things that matter for this study.
Right.
Then it's much more focused and targeted, and you might be able to talk about risk less in some of those meetings, right?
And it's a partnership, right? Because from the study perspective and the leadership perspective of the sponsor, you're thinking about, I need a successful clinical trial portfolio. I don't need one successful trial. I have to see phase 1, 2, 3 go successfully, right? So you're thinking about it from the product level, you're thinking about it from the indication level, you're thinking about your overall risk that's associated with it. Then we got to translate that to what does that mean operationally, right?
Yeah.
And so then you're really building a partnership because everybody is talking about it. It's not like I just sent you the study protocol and you developed a risk register.
Yeah.
Like, those aren't the same people and they're not coming with the same understanding of what are the risks. And I know that even just saying the word risk in that, I don't even want to say it, but it's like, we're not both coming at it from the same perspective. And so we're definitely going to come up with things that aren't necessarily going to get us to the goal, which is spending more time on the things that matter the most and less time on the things that matter less. And so it's, again, it kind of every single parameter, when we think about our key performance indicator, every single parameter is important to somebody. but let's get it down to 10.
Yes.
Right? And let's focus on what can we really do and put all of our energy and attention there. And like you said, at the end of the day, it may lead to less protocol amendments, but it also may lead to quicker recruitment. It may lead to less protocol deviations. It may lead to a faster study getting done quicker, data cleaning getting done quicker, closing that database faster, and then actually getting your drug application in quicker, which is everybody cares about, right?
So that's right.
I think
that's right.
You know, if it builds in the business efficiency if you're focusing on the most important things, and it's kind of obvious a little bit, but kind of also hard to stop and do sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Things are moving so quickly, right? And we've got maybe routines. We know how to do things, even if they're difficult, right? So I think it is hard. So I've enjoyed this very much, but I do want to say, what's one thing that you would have our listeners take away of maybe how they could get started, or one key thing that you want them to take away from all that we discussed today?
Yeah, I think, you know, depending on, you know, what your role is in an organization, I think just understanding that the temperature is changing, right? That the environment is evolving, right? That you don't have to be great at this. You just have to get started, you know? And I think just getting started in any level, you know, one of the things that we did recently, Lori, that I really like a lot is just how to build it simple. Like, we're already making decisions. We're already talking about things and weighing things like, you know, do I need a note to file for this informed consent version that got sent out, but nobody signed it? You know, everybody that's associated with clinical studies are needing to make these decisions that are in the gray areas all the time. So why not put some risk thinking around that, even if it's not like a fully formed, FMEA model or whatever. Maybe it's just, you know, we're gonna sit down and say, if it's straightforward, we just make the decision and that's green.
Yes.
If we need to weigh a few things, let's just take a second and talk through what could go wrong if I did this a different way, right?
Yeah.
And then also have that red where, you know, we are, you know, bringing in more people to the table and just documenting our reasons for making the decision so we have it.
Yeah.
That's risk-based thinking. So it doesn't necessarily need to be burdensome and additive. It really can just be directive. And so I guess my piece of advice would just be start where you are and don't shy away from it. When people start saying the word risk, don't think that that means more work. It could mean just more focused work and more directed work. So, So that's kind of the little advice I would provide. So
I love that, and I will agree with you on that too. It's something, and I don't mean to lower the bar, but something is so much better than nothing, right? And if we don't start somewhere, it's not going to go away. And I think, like we said early on throughout this whole podcast, this one's so clear cut what the benefit is. I think it's so direct, the linkage, that why wouldn't you? I think too, the misunderstanding is a lot of times people don't really know as the sponsor where their role is in that. And they actually feel like they are okay with the CRO. They're not trying to not do something. They're like, oh yeah, we have the CRO do that. We're good. And then they sit down and really dig in and they're like, oh, actually, there is a place for us. And there's a special timing in there for us where we're really the driver of this as the sponsor. And I think if you do it like we're suggesting, you're really just talking and thinking about risk. And it doesn't have to be so scary because you're already thinking about those things anyway. You probably just need to write them down. It's not like they're not coming up, right? The clinical trial in and of itself is risky. So,
and remembering why you said that, you know what I mean?
Yes, like it's like historical knowledge, right?
It's just hard to, like, sometimes you're making so many decisions all the time. And so the rationale behind it is important. And I think we are all kind of thinking about risk differently, but our tolerance levels are different. And we just need to understand like what we're pulling in and why, and not doing things just because we always did it that way, you know? And it's a maturing area, you know, for clinical. Like I said, you know, but we talked about in the past, like, you know, we in GMP, like we are getting better and better. And now those are starting to be really clean, clear ways. Yeah. Honestly, it's like, oh, every time you come up against something in GMP, you're like, oh, let's just do a quick risk assessment. And then, yes. You know what I mean? And we're not there with clinical yet.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the maturity and we want to kind of learn. And I do think the CMC team, there should be a little bit more of a connection because there's a lot of expertise on that side.
100%.
But yes. The companies are very divided a lot of times.
Don't even get me. We could do a whole separate episode on GCP and GMP and why the worlds are separated. But I do want to close out and just thank you for being on here. I really appreciate it. And also, I'm volunteering if there is any company who wants to do a clinical study on increasing sleep in perimenopausal women, I will sign up for that. I will sign that ICF. I will take that risk. Anyway, thank you for joining me, Joy.
Of course. Thank you.
Lori, that was such a lovely interview. And where to start? I love the way Joy brought risk back to the person in the study, you know, a very patient focused conversation. And I know in GMP we often use that word, but there, you know, are they really at the center of the story or the assessment or the change discussion? I feel we're often very distant from the patient. And this just felt very different from how we discuss risk in a GMP environment. And it made that phrase she used, what matters most, it just really made that feel very, very real, you know. And you know, you're looking at it and risk management isn't there to make clinical trials heavier. It's there to make them more thoughtful and more humane. And I loved, you know, when Joy gave that lovely example of what different experts bring to the conversation and the different parts of the risk picture, the clinicians that understand the disease and what the patient is going through, the clinical ops people who are understanding the feasibility and even the stats and the data managers and where they can see where the data is going wrong. I thought that was so insightful, but I just love the bit about the patients and the caregivers and bringing to the protocol and the structure, you know, what's livable, calling people to the clinic four times in a day, you know, they're real world problems. And, you know, she says, in effect, all of us are in our own little bubbles. And I suppose in manufacturing, we'd say our own little silos. And, you know, just the way the argument she made for bringing the right stakeholders to protocol design, I just thought it was lovely. And, you know, I really reflected on it. And what I heard in there was actually a tacit knowledge problem. The knowledge is in the system, but it's distributed. And, you know, the data manager knows where the data usually goes wrong. The clinician knows what he knows. The participant knows what it feels to support these protocols in real life. And I just thought risk management, it just seemed more powerful when, as she described it, creating that structure for that knowledge to meet. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, and you know, I know, Val, I loved the practical approach as well that Joy espoused about ensuring that you're getting, you know, that appropriate tacit patient user input right up front. You know, to ensure it comes back to, you know, the work that we do in OPEX and that, you know, what problem are we solving for? And in this case, it's like, you know, what trial outcomes are we seeking? And which I guess really brings it back to the essence of the guideline itself, which says, you know, clinical trials should be designed to protect the rights, safety and well-being of the participants and to assure the reliability of the results. The overarching principle is, you know, to provide a flexible framework for clinical trial conduct, you know, this new updated guideline. And I think Joy's emphasis on using that flexible or as she called it, stepwise approach, it's both really practical and achievable, really resonated with me. And you know, again, coming back to the example you've just mentioned there, Val, where you shared your own experience, Lori, in trying to do the right thing by attempting to get involved and support a glaucoma trial, only to find out that you'd have to drive to a clinic four times a day to get your eye pressure checked, or else hang out there for the day and pop in and out of the of the trial center to get your four measurements taken. And, you know, you did mention, and again, I loved where Joy talked about, you know, you need to understand where these patients might be coming from in terms of their experiences of the disease. And you mentioned, Laurie, you know, many people with glaucoma are that bit older. And in fact, they may even, you know, typically they'll have restricted vision. So, you know, is it even feasible for them to be driving four times a day or having to be driven four times a day to be getting these kind of, measurements taken? So, I mean, who designed that trial with participant recruitment in mind, you know? And you just wonder sometimes, obviously, there's science and data there behind, we need to get these measurements. But like, just to get that user experience, you know, a lot of what we do nowadays in terms of the design for medical devices is all about that user experience and trying to ensure, you know, that usability has been included. So for me, that taking that patient experience and patient usability early into the trial design seems to me to be, you know, what we refer to as a critical quality attribute of the product around development or design. Never mind the clinical trial design, like the actual product design. You know, asking those questions of, you know, where is the benefit to the patient, or the what's in it for me, for the trial participant to bother rocking up and going through this. Like, again, I say either from the trial design perspective, but perhaps most importantly, asking how is this trial design likely to influence the post-market dosing or drug delivery regime? And is that something patients are willing to take on or even swap their current regime for, you know, that you might be tying yourself into something that patients are saying, well, the eye drops I take now once a night are absolutely doing a fine job. And for the moment, I'd have no inclination to be moving over to a device, you know. So unfortunately, we've seen some very expensive drugs gain approval, you know, very expensive and innovative, you know, using really innovative science. And they reach the market and then, you know, they miss the mark on patient experience and fail to meet their launch expectations. You know, obviously, the hemophilia gene therapy, Roctavian, has been a very public instance of that in recent years. And I see, sadly, that's going to be withdrawn from the market as of next month. You know, great science behind it, great ideas, but just didn't tick the box in terms of looking at patient usability of why would I bother swapping from where I am now, where I'm controlled, to going to, you know, a very innovative gene therapy. But I'm still not sure whether that's going to be something I'm going to have to continue to use at great expense and whether my insurers will follow it. So I think the guideline really reminds us this concept of quality by design, and Joy mentioned it several times, should be implemented, you know, to identify those critical factors and any risks that might threaten those critical factors. And ultimately, coming back to the reliability of the trial results and the outcome, you know, in terms of what the trial is trying to achieve. So that really brought it back for me. I loved that aspect of how she talked about, you know, being really practical about the risk and making sure you're starting from the right place and you're solving the right problem in the first instance.
Yeah. I also appreciated that about her and about how she spoke during the interview too. And I wanted to add that, interestingly enough, ICH-E8 actually really emphasizes that practicality. It really points out the things that matter. And I don't know that I've seen that in any other guidance document really call that out, and even talks a little bit about the culture. You know, you have to have people that are willing to speak up. And, you know, I just don't see that typically called out, maybe other than ICHQ9, right? Mm-hmm. Where it does speak a little bit about that. But what I wanted to add was actually, add to the glaucoma thing, interestingly enough, I was diagnosed at 16. So I was like a baby in the ophthalmologist area, because usually you are diagnosed when you're older with glaucoma. Mm-hmm. And even at 51 in the waiting room, I'm still the youngest
baby,
the youngest person waiting for that. But yeah, that trial was the first time. And I mean, I was a little bit older when that was thrown at me. I was already working in pharma at the time, but I do remember, and I wasn't familiar very much with clinical practices at that time. I was very GMP focused. And I remember thinking, who designed this? Like, who's going to be able to meet these requirements? And so now seeing the progression of ICH-E6R3 and, you know, talking through how risk is looked at, it's like, ah, oh, this is such a great evolution, right? What a great tool that would have been in place had I been, you know, offered that trial before, right? I bet something like that would look a lot different today, right? So
you'll be better set up for the perimenopausal trials you're volunteering.
Yes, did you see that? Yeah, I did. I said, hey, I'm throwing myself out there. I'll sign up.
You'll be so knowing.
Right? Yes, I've lived it. I know. And once again, I did get some sleep last night, but two nights before, no. So I did want to touch on this CRO role here and that relationship between the sponsor and the CRO that Joy talked about. I think that's something I've also talked greatly about with her and with other clients, is the importance to drive home that as the sponsor, you know those unique attributes, you know those potential challenges that are in the design of that protocol. It's your role to identify those CTQs or critical to quality elements up front that are unique about that study. Because as Joy pointed out, the CRO is very much going to operate from a project management, operational, we know kind of the standard risks that come up in a clinical study kind of mode, right? They manage many studies. They are going to do the best they can and a good job. But you as the sponsor know those unique challenges and the things that you're most concerned about, that it's your role to then pass that on to the CRO. They can manage that, but they may not dig into that level of detail, right, in that protocol to kind of understand that. So I just wanted to enhance that piece for people to understand. If you outsource your clinical trial management, you still have to do that piece, because that's what's going to make that stronger connection with the CRO and stronger in how they're overseeing that trial too. And Val, what additional thoughts did you want to share too?
Yeah, and I suppose that applies to external manufacturing relationships as well, just thinking about it. But you mentioned roles there, and there was something that struck me as I was listening to Joy. I think it was the only moment I put my critic's hat back on, right? And she said something very thought-provoking or interesting. You know, when she described putting a rating into the meeting, a risk rating, just to provoke the conversation. And, you know, I can see there's something very practical in that, you know, maybe a draft rating that's a bit out there gives everybody something to disagree with. And then that disagreement can be a doorway to open up, you know, better knowledge harvesting. But of course, when we think about subjectivity and bias, we have to be very careful, because those starting numbers can be an anchor as well. So, you know, just to emphasize that, I suppose that would be the role of a facilitator, isn't it, to make that very clear, because, you know, you're baiting for knowledge. You're not really trying to anchor that score in the meeting. And I thought it was interesting. And Laurie, I know you've used that trick before. It's a kind of an old trick. But, you know, is it because people are reluctant to speak into a blank space, but more willing maybe to correct something that looks wrong and feels wrong, and that starts the ball rolling?
I think so. And when I have facilitated with, and call the acronym what you will, some companies call them study management teams, some of them call them clinical trial management teams, whoever that cross-functional body is that is managing that trial, full of the biostats person, the data management person, the clinical operations people, I noticed culturally there tends to be a little hesitancy to speak out about that ranking, or to even have some of that harder sort of cross-functional discussion of debate, if you will. And so I do also practice that at times, and I'll do something that is extreme so that hopefully it doesn't become an anchor bias. Like if I were to pick the mid-range and go, I think it's here, I think there'd be a little bit more of a risk. versus going, well, actually, I think it's high risk when it's very obviously not, or I think it's low risk when it's very obviously high risk. I think it opens the door for people to feel a little bit more comfortable to speak up. I noticed just in, like I said, culturally, I think those teams run a little bit quieter. And I think if you do something that's so obviously not that thing and it's shown that way by data, especially with a group like that, they're definitely going to speak up and say, no, that's not correct. Right. And then you'll, I think, open the door to sort of break the ice, if you will, and get a little bit more discussion going.
Yeah. Interesting tip. Yeah. Another, and a final thought here, just, I love Joy's parting advice there. As you know, with my risk-based decision-making hat on, I just made a note of what she said. You know, if it's straightforward, we just make the decision and that's green. If we need to weigh a few things, we pause and ask what could go wrong. And if it's more significant, we bring more people in and document the rationale. And I thought that is so practical. It's such a practical expression of risk-based decision-making, because I think sometimes we make all that heavier than it needs to be. And sometimes we create the impression once the word risk appears, we all need a formal tool, a big meeting, a scoring table and lots of documentation. But her point was much more settled and simple and mature than that. It's just your thinking can be proportionate, and it's simply recognizing when something straightforward is straightforward. We know enough, the impact is low, we can move on. Sometimes it just means slowing down enough to ask what could go wrong if we do this differently, or if we don't ask a certain question, or if we omit some piece of knowledge. And then sometimes it's just saying, look, this isn't a simple decision. We need more perspectives, more structure, a clearer record of why we chose the path we chose, you know. And that really resonated with me because, you know, we do struggle with that concept of formality. And formality is not about making everything complicated. It's about matching our level of effort with the importance, complexity and uncertainty of the decision we're trying to make. So, you know, Joy wasn't saying do more risk management. She's saying make your risk thinking more useful, more focused, more natural to the decisions that people are making. And for me, that was a lovely takeaway from this joyful interview.
Well, I'm taking Joy's recommended takeaway, which was, how to build it simple. I loved that, you know, and understanding that the environment is evolving and what looks good is still to emerge. So start with the end in mind. And again, back to that, you know, E6R3 guideline, which states in the introduction, you have to be careful about how you evaluate those critical to quality factors and the risks associated with them, and focus on the activities that are critical to achieving the trial objectives, which obviously is to get this medicine on the market if it's safe to do so. So as Joy advises, you know, trying to meet people where they are, leveraging whatever that specialist knowledge or, you know, based on their role or responsibility, and, you know, trying to understand and document what their concerns or perceived risks are for the trial before herding the whole team, you know, into a room to complete some paper-based risk management exercise designed to assign RPNs to some failure modes, you know, much more practical. So I just loved it as well, really. And it's lovely to expand our discussions, you know, beyond what, you know, where we usually are in the GMP commercial space, and to really understand that this risk-based thinking is across the spectrum now. You know, every new guideline that comes out, every update to a regulation that comes out is all about folding in, you know, this level of formality to suit the risks that are in front of us. So listen, I loved it. I guess that's a wrap. I hope our listeners enjoy it as well. So as usual, we'll be back each month with a range of topics and mix of guest interviews. And we've got our book club coming up, so we'll be posting those on our LinkedIn page and hopefully get some advice from you in terms of anything you want to include on, or you recommend we should include in our book club. Please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so new episodes will miraculously make their way into your feed. And don't forget to, if you haven't already joined us on the LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page, please do so. So finally, Laurie, what do you have in the show notes for this month?
Well, this month, you're going to have some really fun reading. No, it's not going to be super fun, but ICHE6R3, I'll put a link in there. And actually, I really do think that's quite a good document. It's got a lot of juicy stuff in there for QRM. It's quite prescriptive. And then ICHE8R1, I'll include that too, because I like the cultural components in there around how to identify critical to quality attributes. I think it's something that we could even take to heart on the GMP side. And then I do have a registration link to the upcoming PDA Southeast Chapter QRM Practical Skills Workshop. It is in June, exactly on June 11th in Durham, North Carolina. So I'll be presenting there on this very topic, clinical risk management, and there'll be a ton of other great risk management topics as well. It looks like it's going to be a fun day. So I'll include the link for anyone to register for that as well. And it's bye from Lori.
Bye from me, Val.
And goodbye from me, Nuala.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.